Hello, listeners. I wanted to tell you about something that I use and was part of its inception, Joyful.Gifts. Joyful.Gifts is a service that makes giving gifts very easy and joyful. You tell us who you want to give gifts to, set a budget, and then we select, buy, and ship the gift automatically to every occasion, while you have peace of mind. Best of all, you actually save money, since the software continuously mines the web for the best prices for you. If you want to give it a try, it's at joyful.gifts. No www, no .com. Just type joyful.gifts in your browser, and you're set to go. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Cards, episode 87, The Massacre of Belbaes.
First, a couple of housekeeping items. By the end of this episode, Salah ad-Din would be the vizier in Egypt, and Fatimid's period of our story would be finished. Rather than pushing through with the narrative right away, my plan is to pause for a bit after this episode, for a small epilogue episode of that period that looks over things from the big picture perspective. You know, what was life like? How did the Coptic population in Egypt change under the Fatimids? And what changed and what stayed the same with Salah ad-Din? I'm also going to try and arrange for an interview or two, since starting with this episode, there will be lots of information and change in short bursts, and regular interruptions with professional insight would add a lot to our conversation. So, with that out of the way, we can resume our narrative. We last stopped at the conclusion of the Second Crusade and the emergence of a unified Syria in 1154 under Nur al-Din. This new state, with Aleppo as its capital, less than 100 miles away from Antioch, was a serious threat to basically everybody in the region. Most importantly, the Crusader state themselves, especially Antioch, who lost the bulk of its army and its prince to Nur al-Din already, but also to the Byzantines, who feared an alliance between the Seljuks of the Sultanate of Rome and Nur al-Din, and to the Fatimids in Egypt, who were perhaps the easiest and most natural next target for expansion, with its mostly Sunni population and ongoing instability. We last stopped there with the death of Al-Hafiz in 1149. Essentially, the last caliph that was relevant in any way. A 17-year-old son followed him, but he was more concerned about worldly pleasures than any kind of responsible governing. Within a year, another civil war ensued. Really, three different rebellions back to back, but the overall effect was similar to that of one big civil war, lasting from 1149 to 1154, with multiple viziers taking power and then losing it thoroughly after a rebellion. Nur al-Din, a crafty diplomat, tried to build an alliance with one of these short-lived viziers, to hopefully be able to take Egypt without losing men or treasure. But this was just before Damascus fell, and the diplomatic maneuver ultimately failed when the vizier was assassinated and Damascus required Nur al-Din full attention. The Franks, similarly, saw the weakness and took advantage, besieging and then taking Ashkelon in 1154, where an army that was meant to relieve the city rebelled and went to Cairo to install a new vizier instead. Eventually, the caliph himself was assassinated in an ambitious plot to take out the whole dynasty. All the grown men of the dynasty were slaughtered by the vizier, who only kept the women alive and an epileptic child of the caliph also being kept alive as a figurehead. But this again spilled into another civil war, as the women of the dynasty cut their hair and sent it to another Armenian governor in an appeal for help. The son of a soldier brought by Bedr Jemali, who have converted to Shiite Islam, who, like a hero from a Greek tragedy, attached a woman here to the lances of his men. Similar to Radovan, who kick-started this whole thing by attaching the Quran to the lances of his men. But anyway, the Armenian governor, Talay, managed to make his way to Cairo and started a brief period of stability. He quickly arrived to the cynical but probably correct conclusion that the only way his regime in Egypt is to survive was to 1. Keep the soldiers away from Cairo, ideally pursuing holy war that will prop up his regime legitimacy, and 2. To also keep Nur al-Din away, ideally busy pursuing the same holy war as an equal partner rather than a potential enemy. From the Crusader side, they, like Talay, arrived to the same conclusion. If they are to survive, they needed to turn their enemies into allies. The new Prince of Antioch tried to cultivate both the Byzantines and the Armenians, as potential allies, succeeding quickly in winning the alliance of a fearsome Armenian warlord, and, for now, failing to come to an agreement with the Byzantines, who were furious at a crusader raid against the island of Cyprus. Lastly, in that geopolitical dance, the series of successful campaigns from Nur al-Din came to a sudden end in the late 1150s AD, from two things really outside of his control. First, a series of earthquakes damaged a lot of the previously secured castles and fortresses in his domain, which limited the movement of his troops. Second, he was struck down by a serious illness that made it look like he was about to die and caused all kind of palace intrigue around him. Part of that intrigue was to give Shirku, the Kurdish general, uncle of a certain Salah ad-Din, control of Damascus to keep him happy and loyal. Also, the very same illness put the brakes on the plans of Talay to form a grand alliance with Nur al-Din. And so, Talay's men campaigned against the Crusaders alone, with mostly feeble results that we will get to in a second. The most important consequences, though, of the earthquakes and the sickness of Nur al-Din was the re-emergence of the Byzantines as a regional power. They, as I said earlier, while not huge fans of the Crusaders, realized the existential threat that a combined Seljuk alliance would pose, and Nur al-Din was a brilliant diplomat who could make it happen. So they finally warmed up with the idea of an alliance with Jerusalem. The King of Jerusalem was married to the Emperor's niece, followed by the Emperor himself marrying a princess of the Antiochian nobility. As such, in October 1158, a huge Byzantine army landed in northern Syria with the stated goals of capturing Aleppo itself. In return, the Antiochian prince supplicated himself as a servant of the emperor, and the Armenians also agreed to submit to Manuel. So yeah, here, in a typical Byzantine fashion, Antioch and the surrounding Armenian country was turned into client states with symbol deft diplomacy. Now, from the Syrian side, Nur al-Din saw the Byzantines and the Crusaders coming closer and absolutely dreaded the assault. The Crusader knights, while brave and ferocious on the battlefield, were susceptible to infighting and foolish endeavors, not to mention always lacked manpower and resources. Give them the resources and the diplomatic finesse of Byzantium, and they could be extremely dangerous. So, Nureddin bowled every trick in the book not to fight the Byzantines and the Crusaders together. First, he declared formal jihad, gathering warriors from all over the Muslim world to make peace attractive. Second, he decided to release 6,000 captured Franks as a token of goodwill. And lastly, he gave the emperor what he wanted without fighting, a promise to not only stay away from Anatolia, but actively assist Byzantium in fighting the Sultanate of Rum. This was too good of a deal to refuse from Manuel, and really, as far as Byzantium was concerned, it fulfilled the strategic goals of the empire for the campaigns. Antioch was back in the fold, the Armenians checked, and the prospect of a Seljuk alliance taking place was off the table. So the Romans went home, leaving the Crusaders exposed again. Now, while the Spaken force was playing near Antioch, Talai, our Armenian vizier, was sending one campaign after another against Jerusalem. Not only they failed as usual, but in response, the king of Jerusalem, Baldwin III, threatened to invade Egypt and only backed off when Talai promised to pay him tribute. Further complicating the vizier's situation, suffering from frequent seizures and generally sick, died in the same year that the Crusaders were bought off, naturally without any sons or official heirs. So, a brief succession crisis ensued, where Talai got another child, a cousin of the deceased caliph, and appointed him as the new caliph, marrying him off to his own daughter. And that process that brought Talai to power in the first place were pushed aside, and in some cases executed, as the vizier accumulated more and more power. Finally, fearing for their position and lives, the princesses of the dynasty arranged for the assassination of the Armenian governor in 1161. A bungled attempt that morally wounded the vizier rather than outright killing him, just giving him enough time to arrange for his son to succeed him, and making sure that the princess behind the attempt is executed before dying. The son wasn't really up to the task, so. And ambitious men all over the country made plans to replace him in Cairo. One of these men was a certain Bedouin named Shawar, appointed by Talai to be the governor of Kus in Upper Egypt, and then removed by the son. He naturally did not like the removal, so he rebuilt, succeeding in gathering a Bedouin coalition that successfully took Cairo in 1163, beginning the final phase of the Fatimids' long decline. You see, Shawar and his Bedouins had no friends in the army or the civil administration, and were sort of outsiders. They threatened everyone who was part of the system, the professional soldiers, the civil elite, the religious leaders, really everyone. And to make matters worse, to reward his soldiers, Shawar sort of gave them a free hand in pillaging the land, which not only made them unpopular in the street, but alienated the elite who owned those lands. So, again, one of the army generals rebelled within a couple of months of Shawar entering Cairo. He succeeded in his rebellion, given Shawar unpopularity, and the Bedouin had to escape Cairo, like many before him. But what made his short reign stick was, rather than disappearing into the twilight like the five or so irrelevant viziers before him, he hanged on, fighting to keep his power no matter the end results. If you remember, Bahrain preferred to step away rather than be the king of ashes. Well, Shawar was the polar opposite, going to the very extreme to continue to rule Egypt. Fully knowing the consequences, he went to none other than Nur al-Din, asking for help. And here, my friends, where everything finally comes together. At this very moment, Nur al-Din, after surviving all the tribulation of the 1150s, with the earthquakes, the sickness, the Byzantines, was finally in a position to expand his growing empire. And Egypt was right there, Shawar practically begging for him to take it, 1/3 of its tax revenue to be exact. And so, he decided to take it, sending Shirku, the Kurdish general in Damascus, with 2,000 horsemen to take Egypt and install Shawar as the vizier. In response, the army general who took Shawar's place also with little regard for the potential consequences, reached out to the crusaders, King Amalric at this point, to come to his aid. It was a little too late, so. By the time the crusaders were ready, Shawar and the Seljuks from Syria managed to retake Cairo after an indecisive and a bloody civil war that saw lots of civilian casualties. The history of the patriarchs records how, as a result of that war, slaves were so abundant that the slave markets were flooded. You can buy a black slave for as little as 5 dinars and a Christian young woman for 20 dinars. And as the civil war was indecisive, Shawar control was limited at best. He could only pay Nur al-Din, or really Shirku at this point, 30,000 dinars, a tiny amount compared to the promised 1/3 of Egypt's tax revenue. So, Shirku broke the alliance and declared war against Shawar, perhaps looking for an excuse to conquer Egypt outright and rule as the vizier. Wisely so, he did not stay in Cairo, where the situation was unstable and he was liable to alienate its populace. Rather, he camped in the delta, with the goal to pressure Shawar to pay more money as tribute, or, if he's lucky, ride out another rebellion to annex the country altogether. In response to Shirku breaking the alliance, Shawar, still clinging to his power, reached out to the only people that could help him. Yep, the Crusaders. And so, King Amalric and a Crusader army arrive to also conquer Egypt. Now, everyone was here. Shirku, representing Nur al-Din and the Syrians, the Crusaders, and the Fatimids, or Shawar, depending on how you see it, all locked in a three-way struggle to decide on the fate of Egypt. Unfortunately for the flow of a good podcast narrative, there ended up being an indecisive struggle, a tie, so to speak. The Crusaders besieged the Syrians in the delta and were making good progress. And so, Shirku reached out to Shawar to see if they can come to an agreement again. You know, maybe instead of 30,000 dinars, 60,000 would do the job. And they ended up agreeing on a 60,000 dinars tribute. In the same time, Nur al-Din in Syria was moving inside Crusader territory, capturing a strategic town already, which made the Crusaders eager to wrap up the siege and go home and deal with Nur al-Din. So, everybody disengaged. Shirku left after getting his 60,000 dinars, the Crusaders left to deal with Nur al-Din, and Shawar, well, he was left to be the King of Ashes. A short reign, lasting for just 1 year, as everybody decided to come back and do the same dance in 1167. You see, while Nur ad-Din personally was rethinking the whole Egypt thing, knowing that he will have to fight both the Crusaders and Shawar only to get a scarred land difficult to govern, Shirku, his general in Damascus, well, having gotten a taste of what is possible, really wanted to conquer Egypt and rule it as its vizier. He had served loyally for a lifetime now, and he kind of wanted his own kingdom and legacy to leave behind. So, entirely driven by personal ambition, rather than a rational and a thoughtful process, and really, without Nur ad-Din fully on board, Shirku gathered a small personal army to go conquer Egypt in the middle of winter of 1167. Taking with him his nephew, the police chief of Damascus and a rising star in the nobility of Nur ad-Din kingdom, Yusuf ibn Shadi ibn Ayyub, better known to history as Salah ad-Din. At this point, a 29-year-old aristocrat with limited experience beyond making the market merchants use the correct weights. More on him as we move into our narrative. For now, so, Shirku's invasion force prompted Shawar to ask the Crusaders for help again, promising them an unrealistic tribute of 400,000 dinars. Either believing the unrealistic number, or more likely, with plans to annex the whole country as well. The army of Jerusalem showed up, crossing the borders on the heel of Shirku in February 1167. Deja vu. Like last time, all three sides were locked an indecisive series of battles. First, Shirku arrived to Cairo, only to find the gates firmly shut, and the Crusaders in hot pursuit. Not wishing to get trapped, he bypassed the capital and moved south, where the Crusaders caught up to him, and a very bloody battle took place. After which, Shirku kinda gave up on Cairo on Upper Egypt and moved north to Alexandria, where the city welcomed him, and he installed Salah ad-Din as its commander with a small garrison. He himself, so, moved quickly from the city, as Shawar and the Crusaders were on their way to besiege the city, and he did not want to get trapped in a painful siege. The eventual fate of young Salah ad-Din, who had to endure that painful siege, that perhaps became the best lesson in the misery of warfare to the young noble. His uncle, so, not confident in being able to best the combined Egyptian and Crusaders army in an open battle or to be able to break the siege, he kept moving from one city to another, hoping for his enemies to make a mistake or for the population to rise up and support him. But neither happened, and by the end of the summer and the Nile about to flood, it became clear that the campaign was a failure. Shirku retreated, and Salah ad-Din surrendered Alexandria in return for safe passage to the Crusaders. Shawar, our Bedouin vizier, still remained in power, but was the Crusader extracting 100,000 dinars yearly tribute for their efforts, as well as installing a garrison in Cairo itself. Here we are, for this very brief moment of history. Egypt was so close to be an outright Crusader state. And Amaruk, the king of Jerusalem, knew it as well. He was an ambitious fellow and had ambitious plans. For a few years now, he was trying to convince the Byzantines to participate in a joint North African invasion that included Egypt. And at this point, they actually have agreed in principle. Also, the details were being hashed out. And here he stood, literally inside Cairo, having turned the Fatimids into a client state. A patient man would have kept the status quo for a year, hashed out the details with the Byzantines, and, you know, turned the client state into an outright conquered land. But Amalric was not a patient man, and his knights had no desire to share the spoils of victory with anyone. And so, a mere 2 months after the victory, in October 1167, the Crusaders were inside of Egypt again, this time to conquer outright. The first city that they encountered was Bilbais, which had a healthy, perhaps even majority, Christian population. It was not much in terms of defenses or even an army to defend it. The city surrendered to the Crusaders within a couple of days. But, as was the habit, the entire population of the city was massacred or enslaved. You know, Christians, Muslims, men, women, children, everybody. The city population was entirely gone. Like I said earlier, the Crusaders and their own were susceptible to foolish endeavors, and the massacre of Bilbais was how exactly one would shoot himself in the foot. They came into a land suffering for decades now from ineffectual rule and violence. The bar to be welcomed by the populace, or at least its elite, was as low as it will ever get. Chawar, the king of that land, was universally hated by everybody. It really doesn't get much easier than that. You know, to show up, do something, anything, really short of killing everybody, and the door would be open to you. Instead, the Crusaders managed somehow to turn the scheming and destructive Chawar into a beloved saint, a defender of the common folks, given what just happened in Bilbais. And it's extremely hard to justify the massacre as part of any rational plan. I mean, even if the strategy was similar to the Abbasids crushing the Bashmirites revolts earlier in our narrative, you know, a brutal scorched earth campaign to just depopulate the land and start new, it would have meant that the Crusaders continued to move decisively and quickly until they captured Cairo and pacified the entire land. But that's not how it happened. After Bilbais, the Franks slowed down their march considerably, heavy with slaves and loot, and perhaps under the impression that Chawar is about to surrender, since he didn't have much in terms of troops, and in a desperate move, he decided to burn the whole city of Fustat to deny its capture and defenses to the Crusaders. Fustat at this point was like a suburb of Cairo, so it was really an act of desperation. Instead, their march was so slow that the vizier managed to send several messages to Nuruddin begging for help. And Nuruddin, after careful consideration of the pros and cons, agreed. Sending Shirku again was a treasury of 200,000 dinars, as well as a 7,000 horsemen army. He also personally convinced Salah ad-Din to go again, scarred as he was from the Alexandrian siege, and not wanting to go through anything like that ordeal again. At this point, 2 months later, the Crusaders were still taking it very easy. Shirku's army dashed through Sinai and made it to the Nile Valley, and they still have not reached Cairo. When the word reached Amalric, he decided to stop his advance and go back and regroup in Bilbais, hoping that Shirku would go to him. And when that didn't happen, he decided that he would be better off if he can intercept the Kurdish general in Sinai. like the Fatimids in the First Crusade saw. The army of Jerusalem was always a step or two behind. By the time they were in Sinai, Shirku had bypassed them altogether and was in the Nile Valley. He kinda had no need to fight the Crusaders. All what he needed to do is to get to Cairo, and then he can fight the Crusaders on his own terms. Perhaps was Nur al-Din launching his own campaign in Syria, reaching the same conclusion where he would have to fight on multiple fronts? Amalek decided to call it a day and retreat, not only failing in the campaign, but basically leaving the door right open for Shirku and Nur al-Din to take Egypt, and losing the very valuable foothold that he had achieved earlier with a garrison inside Cairo. Also, lest you forget, making any future plans with the Byzantines 10 times harder now. In less than a month, Shirku was besieging Cairo, a short 8-day siege. Shawar, like I said, was hated by everybody, and he had no chance. The Caliph himself welcomed the Kurdish general. As for the Bedouin vizier, well, he was executed on sight by Salah ad-Din himself, if we are to believe his court poets. Shirku was appointed as the new vizier, but as fate would have it, he died only 2 months after arriving in Cairo, in March 1169. Following him was his nephew, the new vizier, Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi. Thank you for listening, farewell, and until next time.